way to go, recording that.
As I recall it, the first Hoover digger that was ever brought into Rustic County was brought in by a man by the name of Wallace Dykeman. And the first one that he had, as I recall it, was in 98. And our farm being so near town, right in town, so to speak, there's where he brought it up to try it out so more people could see it. And I remember very well, it was a day when there wasn't any school and I was home, and I remember of running it, driving the horses on it. And that revolutionized the raising of potatoes. And it was unfortunate, that one was only 12 inches wide, this famous Hoover digger. Well, we tried it out, and Father had 10 acres of potatoes at that time, and that seemed like a big field in those days. Well, the digger stayed there, and we used it and demonstrated and dug those potatoes with it. Well, then he had it sent back, and the next year the diggers came for the carload, and they were 15 inches wide, which took in the whole row. Well, then they went up country, and Wallace made quite a little fortune selling the Hoover diggers.
Do you remember how much they cost?
If I remember correctly, they cost about $200. And were we buying one of them today, there'd be probably four or five times that. But if I remember correctly, it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $200.
Let's turn that off.
As I remember it, the first potato planter ever brought into Rustic was called the Evans planter, and was brought in by a man by the name of Charles Parsons from Presque Isle. And our farm being so near Houghton, that he brought it there for us to try out. And I remember very well staying, it was during the school hours, and I remember three or four of us boys trying to, well, didn't go to school, stayed and watched it work a while, but did a wonderful job. And that was really the beginning of increasing the acreage. And at that time, with one of those machines and properly tended, a man in the field that had the potatoes dumped from the barrels into baskets to put into the planter and so forth, so they could reload quickly. It was quite a job. They used to plant 5 or 6 acres a day. And that certainly was a big jump from dropping them by hand. I can remember so well dropping them by hand. They would take something and make a row, an old horse hoe, and make a row. Well, then, kids, I can remember when I was 6, 7 years old, we'd have a pail with these cut seed in it, and we would drop them in these rows. And the big thing was to get them about 8 inches. Well, I remembered we got some 6 inches and some 16, but anyway, they all grew. And it was a big jump from that to having this planter. Well, it went along a couple years, and then another one called the Aspinwall planter appeared. And from that on, every machinery company, the Deere and the International, all they had planters. And there were carloads after carloads of them sold in Aroostook County. And taking that planter and the digger into consideration, of course, the acreage jumped. Well, now it went to, I think, if I remember correctly, it was 96 or 97 that the planter, the Hoover digger, was a couple years behind it. Well, we got to raising a lot of potatoes in the county. And I well remember when Cleveland Company planted 20 acres of potatoes down back where John Madigan, Dr. Madigan, lives now, when that was a hall true of the farm, no houses down back there. And I remember going down there when they were digging, and the field was full of people there watching. It was a tremendous sight, 20 acres, and they were getting 80 to 90 barrels the acre. Of course, in those days, they didn't use nearly so much fertilizer. 10 or 1,200 was old, an immense amount, which now, if you don't put on a ton, you don't get anything. But that's the way it developed. Well, then, we got it to going, and they got to raising so many potatoes. And then, when the B&A came in 92, that just revolutionized the potato business. And the first potato, I well remember, the first potato house ever built on the B&A was built by a man by the name of Harris Porter here in Houghton. The house is still in existence. Harry Bass owns it. But from that day on, the potato business increased. And I can remember a few years ago when they used to haul out from 50 to 75 carloads a day from a rooster.
How large were the farms at the turn of the century?
Well, about that time, the farms had been laid out in the various towns, and 100 acres was sort of standard acreage. Well, most of the farmers for quite a while planted 8 to 10 acres, but they gradually got increased so that with the modern machinery, they went up to 50 to 20. And I remember when my own father jumped from 20 acres up to 40 acres. Of course, we were more fortunate than a lot of people because our farms were right in town and we had no trouble getting plenty of help. But the farmers out in the country, it was quite a problem if they got over 10 or 15 acres on account of the labor situation and getting them picked. But in a few years, the Canadians got on to the idea of coming over here to pick potatoes. And believe me, when a carload of Canadians appeared here to pick taters, they got a very cordial reception. And they would pick potatoes. And many of the good men would average 100 barrels a day. And of course, those days, we got them picked for about 5 to 10 cents a barrel. But anyway, the thing kept a growing from that. Well, then, it got along, so there would be some contractors like the Reed brothers at Fort Fairfield and Harry Umphrey and some of them that had bigger companies. They would buy 2 or 3 farms and go after it in a big way. Well, that is what it's really developed into. Today, with the cost of machinery as it is, you buy a 100-acre farm, and if you're going to make it pay, you've got to plant, well, around 40 to 50 acres of potatoes. Well, it'll cost you just as much to get equipped with machinery and trucks and so forth as it did to buy the farm. And the same equipment that you would have to plant 40 or 50 acres, you could handle 75 to 100 acres with the same equipment. And that's what kind of got them to every fellow trying to have a bigger farm, controlling 2 or 3 farms. Well, then when it got along that Uncle Sam was letting a lot of the farmers have apparently unlimited money to finance their operations, a lot of farmers started buying these extra farms. And so many farmers' sons didn't want to stay home and farm, that as the older people kind of had to retire, they sold their farms to a neighbor who had sons or had the courage to increase his acreage. And that's the way the potato situation grew. Now,
What were the different kinds of crops and materials raised or produced on the farm about 1900?
Well, the only things that were produced in 1900 was potatoes and the various kinds of grain, oats especially, and then many farmers had buckwheat. That was great. It was sure of a good crop with buckwheat, and that made a good feed for cattle. But it was many years before, oh my land, it was 50 years before it came along that the pea factory, Snyder people, came here to Houghton and started a pea processing plant.
What date would that be? Do you have any idea?
About 1925, and they were a wonderful company. Mervyn LaRue, we well remember, he was the manager, the head man, and George Watts was one of them. And they were very popular with the farmers, and they got the pea acreage going in good shape. I well remember that fellows would sign up for peas. When they came to Houghton, they told us that they would have to be guaranteed 600 acres before they would locate here. Well, two or three of us spent our time canvassing with them, and I well remember we get up to 400 acres. In those days, it was different with the farmers. We worked together. There were four of us right near Houghton here who were very friendly, and our farm bosses were. There was Moore's Company, Cleveland Company, and Charlie McCluskey and Putnam Brothers. Well, we got up to 400 acres, and we had each signed up for 20 acres. Well, they were all ready to leave town when we four fellows got together and decided, well, it was going to be a terrible blow if we didn't get them. So we decided where we would work together and help one another, that it was safe for us to sign up for 100 acres. The way it was with peas, they would inspect them, and they would tell you that they'd got to be cut the next day or they'd be too hard. So we four of us, signed up for 100 acres. Well, they debated whether we would be capable to handle them or not, and we told them that we were taking a bigger risk than they were. Well, they decided to let us have it. Well, then we each bought the proper cultivars and so forth. And someday, we would be told we'd have 30 acres to cut the next day. Well, the other fellows would come and help us cut them. I remember many days we put in 100 loads of peas from one of the four farms to the refinery. Well, the way it would work, and the Cleveland Company would have a big lot, and our crews would go there and all that day. That was one of the great things about peas. You knew just when you had to cut them, and you knew how to do it. But that worked out good, and the pea factory went along good here until a couple of the quartet of four of us retired. Well, that took us down to only two planting 100 acres. And there were so many fellows that would take 8 and 10 acres. Well, now it cost them, the Snyder people, just as much to inspect those peas. They inspected them every week during the summer as it would if they had 50. Well, they gradually got kind of fed up on that kind of a proposition and decided that they went to Caribou. There were a lot of bigger growers up there signed up. Well, they went up to Caribou and closed this plant here and did a whale of a business up there. But due to the high cost of labor and so forth, they have decided to close the Caribou plant. So Aristic is losing out altogether on the pea business. Well, then the farmers had great hopes of the beet business. Well, there's too much in the papers today now that's all explained why that the farmers haven't been paid for the peas last year yet, so they're not planting again. But We've got to have another crop besides the peas. The oat business is kind of gone by because farmers don't have horses at all now. And you can sell them, but you can't make much money raising just oats. So I don't know. It looks pretty tough for the rustic farmer unless we can get the pea and beet business to go in too.
Is that sound?
One of the great things that we had back in those days was the lumbering. I'll take it here at Houghton, for instance. We had two mills here, Matt Wilson and Frank Titcomb. Well, the lumber was practically all cut upon township letter B, that's north of Houghton. Well, most every fellow that had a pair of horses on the farm when the winter, we'd put them in the woods up there, and they worked in the woods. Well, that was the way it was all over the county. And it was the lumber in the mills that kept us going. The rustic is always prospered when they have been prosperous, using what we produced. Well, that's why these potato processing plants are profitable. They're using our potatoes. But that seems to be growing all the time. There's an outfit talks some about starting a plant here at Houghton, which I hope they do. But the big thing is the cost now. And of course, back in the 25 years ago, if it cost $75 to $100 to raise an acre of potatoes, when you're putting on a ton of fertilizer and all of that, why, it seemed a big amount. But conservatively, any farmer this last year that did it with mostly hired help and so forth had nearly $400 cost in every acres of potatoes. Well, if he has 100 to 125 of saleable potatoes to an acre, you can see that he's got to get a pretty good price or he won't make anything. But it's a terrible gamble, this raising potatoes. And whether it's right or wrong, there's a big fight on to do away with the mercantile. But I don't know which is best. But anyway, there's a large delegation from Arusta going to Washington to try to get them to pass a bill prohibiting them having potatoes in the mercantile. But time will tell.
Oh, yes.
Were most farmers self-sufficient?
Well, back 30, 40 years ago, the average farmer was self-sufficient. If we saw a farmer coming into Houghton and buying his milk, we thought he was on the road to ruination. But they supported themselves, and they did all the work with the horses, and they simply hired extra help for a while during the summer when they needed it. But as a rule, they raised a great deal of the stuff that they consumed. And a lot of the farmers' wives made butter and, oh, I don't know. They had many ways of self-support. And the farmers in those days, it was considered, well, a very rare thing for a fellow to have to mortgage his farm. But it makes you wonder just what the thing is coming to ride out through some of these towns. Take it, for instance, Ludlow, and going on some of those back roads and see about three out of every four farms closed up and Uncle Sam owning them. They got loans that they couldn't pay. And it's amazing. Take it within 25 or 30 miles of Houghton, the farms that Uncle Sam has to sell today. And that's all one thing that it was wonderful of the government possibly to let the farmers have this money. But on the other hand, they made it possible for many farmers to hire a lot more than they would ever be able to pay back. When if they'd had to gone to the bank to get the money, they wouldn't have been in that box, and there's a lot of them realize it today. They'll say, well, if they hadn't let me have so much, I wouldn't be in debt. But that's the way it worked. But today, in some of these towns, a third of the farms are either heavily mortgaged or foreclosed by the government. Well, that means the government's got them to sell. And there they are, growing up with weeds and so forth. So it's a very discouraging situation. And it's got so in Rustic County today, as I see it, the only farmer that can make it pay is a fellow that does it on a big way. And he can afford to hire the help. Back, say, 30 years ago, why, if a man got $8 to $10 a week working on a farm, he was being big pay. Well, if they don't get 3 or 4 times that now, they want work. So you can see the price is gone. And back, say, 20 years ago, a potato planter was only about a quarter of what it would cost to buy one today. And that's the way with all machinery. So it's a very expensive game now.
I don't know what we did.
About 1900, what kinds of machines or tools were made locally?
Well, in around 1900, one of the things that I well remember made locally was a double wagon. Of course, in those days, it was all horses. We had to have the greatest wagons. And a man by the name of Silas Tabor, who was located on Mechanic Street, made double wagons. And they, to this day, you find ones down then through the country. They were wonderful. Then the Houlton Foundry made what the first kind of what we call cultivators we ever had. And I remember they sold like hotcakes. And then, of course, after that, the machinery people kept bringing some. Well, then, I would say it was a few years after that, the Houlton Foundry came out with a double horse hoe arrangement that made it possible with a pair of horses to hoe 2 rows at once rather than the one. Well, they sold a lot of them because that was a great saving in time. See, the men and teams are doing twice as much work a day. Well, it graduated along, and year after year, some of the machinery people would develop these machines. I remember it was in about 1905 or 6 that we got the first disc harrow came into Rustic. The Walter A. Wood people shipped them in here. Well, they seem like a very simple thing now, but they made a great sensation then because they ground the fields up and made them very nice to work to raise potatoes and so forth. So it's just been one improvement another. And it'd be interesting if the Peabodys would tell about the machinery they started with and what they have to have now. They've done a tremendous business, you know, the John Deere people. But there's been several of those machinery companies, the John Deere and the International and various machinery outfits have kept up, made the machinery as the farmers needed it, of different kinds.
How are most farm homes heated in the winter?
They were heated by stoves and fireplaces, and every farmer during the fall would get up a sufficient wood from the woodlot on his farm to keep them going all winter. And of course the choice wood was good hardwood, maple or birch. But they always, every farmer had a nice pile of wood in his yard. And that's the way the houses were heated. Very few of them had furnaces, but they were airtight stoves and fireplaces. And they had the old-fashioned stove in the kitchen that gave out a lot of heat. And that's the way their heat worked in the winter.
How many fireplaces in a house would you have in a farmhouse?
What?
How many fireplaces would you have?
Well, generally about one. Lot had 2. I know our home on the North Street here had three, and what a land of wood that we burned there. But that's the way it went. They were, it was before coal and oil and all of that. It was just hard, good wood cut on the farm.
What was the farmer's basic means of transportation in 1900?
Well, the transportation in 1900 was wholly by horse, and lots of farmers had, few had covered carriages, most of them had just wagons, and a lot of them had buckboards. They used the buckboards to, well, haul milk to the town and so forth, but they all, it was just the horses, and the majority of the farmers kept one driving horse, and the rest were bigger horses that worked on the farm.
Were oxen ever used in arithmetic?
You what?
Were oxen ever used?
Oh, yes. Back in those days, there were a few farmers had a yoke of oxen. That would be a pair. And they used them on the farm some. And they were not very expensive because they could, the day they didn't use them, they'd turn them out to pasture and so forth. But the oxen used to do a lot of in the older days, with some of the older farmers who were accustomed to them, they did quite a lot of the heavy work on the farm.
How extensive was the use of chemical fertilizers and insecticides in your youth?
Well, I would say that they started using some fertilizer about 1915, and they thought if you put on a ton on 2 or 3 acres, it was sufficient. But of course, that has been outgrown. If they don't put a ton on now, they miss it. But in those days, the only chemical used was Paris Green. And I can well remember when we used to take these hand sprinklers that would hold about 3 gallons. And mix the kerosene, the Paris Green, with water, and then go along the rows and spray them with this hand sprayer to get the bugs. Well, then eventually, John Watson Company came out and made a sprayer with barrels on it that held about 3 or 4 barrels of water, and we would, and then had booms on them that laid down and nozzles and would spray 4 to 6 rows at a time. And this rig was, it was all mixed with the Paris Green. Well, then, of course, a pair of horses hauled it, and that's the way we killed the bugs. Well, then later on, the experiment at station at U of M discovered that if we put some lime in with it, it would help keeping the potatoes from rusting. Well, then it grew that there had to be so many pounds of lime put into every 100 gallons of water, and there was this mixture of lime and Paris Green went on the potatoes every year. And it was some job, too, to get that on and get it mixed and so forth. But that was the first beginning. Well, of course, it got to going then. Sooner or later, every company had a nice sprayer, and they had them up, same as they do now, you know, that'll take 8 to 10 rows. And of course, this spraying from the air, as some of them are doing, is something new within the last 8 or 10 years. But that's the way the potato industry kind of got to going. Well, of course, on a field that was to be planted, they would take and haul all of the dressing, a manure, as you might call it, from the barns out and spread it on the land before it was plowed. Well, then, of course, when they went on and harrowed it and so forth, that was all mixed with the ground and so forth, and that helped a lot. And as they got to keeping less cattle and had less manure, why, they put on more fertilizer. And that's the way it kind of grew right up.
What was the job of the women around the farm?
Well, the housewife was a very busy woman. They had the meals to get, and generally they had a hired man or two to board, and as a rule, quite a family. And the women always used to have a flock of hens, and many of them made quite a lot of butter that they sold. But they all, everybody connected with the farm was busy. There was something for them to do. And as soon as the boys got big enough, they helped in the field, and the girls would help their mothers. And that's the way it went. And that was the way the farmers became prosperous. I think Rustic was built up fundamentally by self-supporting families all over the county. And in those days, it was looked upon as a kind of a disgrace. A man that came into town and bought any butter or milk or anything. In fact, he was kind of wondered about if he ate in town.
What was the job of the women around the farm?
Well, the housewife was a very busy woman. They had the meals to get, and generally they had a hired man or two to board, and as a rule, quite a family. And the women always used to have a flock of hens, and many of them made quite a lot of butter that they sold. But they all, everybody connected with the farm was busy. There was something for them to do. And as soon as the boys got big enough, they helped in the field, and the girls would help their mothers. And that's the way it went. And that was the way the farmers became prosperous. I think Rustic was built up fundamentally by self-supporting families all over the county. And in those days, it was looked upon as a kind of a disgrace. A man that came into town and bought any butter or milk or anything. In fact, he was kind of wondered about if he ate in town. But they got over that. But the farmers was what you might term as self-sustaining in those days. And it was considered quite an oddity for a good farmer that had to come in and mortgage his farm. But that kind of custom went by, and many of them have since.
Did the women make clothes? Or didn't?
Oh, yes. The women made mostly, made all the clothes for the children, of course, great deal of their own. And I remember some of them. Out in the country here, you'd see a farmer come, well, my wife made this coat for me, and so forth. They were quite...
In Aroostook County.
Well, the coming of the B&A to Houghton in 93 revolutionized the whole potato industry because it gave us an opportunity and a way to ship our potatoes to the Boston and New York markets, which we weren't able to do that previous to the B&A coming, except by the CP. Well, it took a day, sometimes 2 days longer, to get a carload of potatoes from here to Boston by the CP than it did B&A. Consequently, we never cut into the Western market much until the B&A came. Well, when the B&A came, of course, the people were potato conscious then, and they increased their acreage very much year by year. And as the potato houses were built along the tracks, why, of course, people had a chance to store the potatoes. I might add that the first potato house built on the B&A was built at our B&A here in 94 by Harris Porter. The house is owned today by Harry Bass. It's right back of the large John Watson house on Bangor Street. But that was the first one built in the county. Well, in every year after that, there were potato houses built at the different stations, and that gave the farmers a place to store the potatoes, and then during the shipping season, they would load them into the cars and ship them. Well, most of them went to Boston or New York, and that way it started the potato industry going. I well remember the different teams that came down the North Road, especially during the winter season, from up north as far as Mars Hill. During 86, at 87 and 89, I ran a series of broken legs. I broke my leg three times, right near the hip, and was flat on my back for 4 months each time. And they had my bed in the window, so I could watch out. Well, I was entertaining myself during the days, counting the loads of potatoes going down the North Road. And I can remember as well as though it was yesterday. About 10 o'clock in the morning, there'd be 20 or 25 loads go by that were from Monticello in Bridgewater. They'd gotten along. Well, then in the middle of the afternoon, during the afternoon, there'd be 40 to 50 loads of potatoes go down that had come from as far as north as Mars Hill. And I often think now of those people bringing those potatoes. They had these long sleds with canvases over their potatoes to keep them from freezing. They'd have on 25 to 30 barrels, and they would be able to get, thought they were getting a big price when they got a dollar a barrel. Well, they'd come clear down here with those potatoes, then stay overnight and go back home the next day. And that's the way many of them paid for their farms, was what they made out of those potatoes. Well, of course, when the B&A came and we got potato houses all up the line, why, that was an incentive for them to plant more potatoes, and consequently it's increased immensely. The B&A came into Houghton in 93. Well, in 94, they started building the potato houses, and from then on, the potato business grew very fast.
Is that all? Let's see, this is here.
You're on, go ahead.
Right there.
Of course, when the B&A came, the machinery people, the Walter A. Wood, the John Deere, and the International, all of them, started shipping carloads of various kinds of machinery in here. And that, of course, previous to that, all of the potatoes had been planted, dropped by hand, and dug by hand, and all of that. But in... Well, I'll tell them about the potato planter first.
Yeah, I think we talked about that the other day.
Yeah, we did. Well, I recall when we had what they called the first digger. It was the Reuther. Well, that just simply elevated the potatoes, went up over them, an elevator, and got the dirt out of them. Well, they were dropped behind the digger. Well, then, of course, it went from that until in 97. I remember it very well because they tried it out in our field. And Wallace Dykeman brought in a Hoover digger that had just come out. And that was one that did a good job. It dug the potatoes, and there were elevators that run them aside and all of that business. And that was really the beginning of the being able to harvest a good big crop. Well, the first digger he brought was only 12 inches wide, the elevator. That wasn't quite enough, but he was so encouraged that he got the Hoover people. They made the next one 18 inches wide, and then he started in, and he shipped them in by the carloads here and sold an endless number. And that was a great help.
Yeah.
Of course, up to this time, these diggers and everything had been hauled by horses. But as I recall, it was around 36 that we commenced to get tractors in. Well, of course, that was a great move when the tractors came, and that did away with keeping so many horses, and it was a great help. And it was a wonderful way to dig the potatoes and all of that with tractors, with the tractors, and they were a lot sold. I remember we sold the International tractor, Putnam Brothers Company did, and I remember when, what a sight we thought was when we had a carload of come, three on a car. But they, the farmers picked them up. And in those days, they cost about a quarter of what they cost today. So it was quite a change since then. Does that sound all right?
Oh, no.
Yeah. When I think of the modern way of handling these potatoes, I think of my own young days when I was home going to school, when we had potatoes. Well, that was, you see, before the railroad came, mostly, and we only planted, 4 to 6 acres. It was a big lot. Well, that's about typical of what most farmers did. But to store them, they put them in the basement of their houses. And you can imagine what a job it was to get those potatoes in the little windows in the sides of the wall, get them into the cellar. Well, then when they were sold and taken out, you had to put them in barrels and lug them up the stairs. And I remember very well what a job that was. Well, then, of course, it was a great move when we got to building the potato houses on the railroad. Well, then from that, some of the farmers got on to building what they call outdoor storage on their farms. On the side of a hill, they would dig in and they'd build a potato house there.
What year would that be? Do you have any idea?
Oh, I think though they started around 1938 or so, about that period. There was very few built. Of course, many farmers were skeptical. They couldn't keep them from freezing. But they got on to the fact that they had them well banked and would have a stove in them, and it made a very easy way to store the potatoes and an easy way to get them out, and they wouldn't have to pay storage at a potato house like they would if they put them in a potato house at the railroad. So there's been great changes in the handling of the potatoes. And I can recall when E.L. Cleveland Company had 20 acres of potatoes on the so-called Trowithy farm, which is where all of Fairview is, in back of where John Madigan lives. Well, when they were digging those potatoes, there were people coming from miles around seeing this immense field of potatoes. That was the first big field, what we called quite big field in this area. But of course, that's just a garden plot with most of them now. But it's just amazing the way the potato industry's increased since the V&A came in here in 94.
What do you remember of the agricultural fairs of the early part of this century?
Well, in the early part of the century, most people had quite a lot of cattle and so forth, and many farmers prided themselves on it. And as a result of their enthusiasm and efforts, they formed a Houghton Agricultural Society. Well, then they would have fairs, and the first of them that I can remember was just an exhibition of a lot of cattle and animals, and they charged admission and they paid premiums. Well, then it came along, and my father and Uncle Mel built a trotting park right where we're living now, The track was went right along where my house is, and the grandstand was right over where my son Albert's house, and there was a half a mile track here. Well, Agricultural Society came in and had the fair, and they had racing in connection with it. It would last a week. There'd be 5-6 days of racing and judging these cattle. Well, when they got the horse racing going and so forth, it developed into a pretty big affair with the fair and everything. And I can remember when there'd be 100-150 choice animals here, and they'd bring their fancy horses and everything and pigs and so forth. But it was really an agricultural fair. But it went along for years that way. Well, then, as the younger farmers grew up, so many of them didn't stay on the farms that the older fellows kind of didn't keep so much stock, and the cattle business kind of died out. But they had to raise their premiums so there would be carloads of cattle shipped from downstate up here to our fair. So that went along, but eventually it kind of dried up and there was nothing left but the horse racing. Well, of course, we don't have that now, much to my sorrow, but that's the way the fair business went. And of course, the big fair today, there's just one big fair in the county, and that's the Presque Isle Fair. But they still have an awful lot of farmers in the surrounding towns there and up the river who bring cattle to their fair. The Presque Isle Fair and the Bangor Fair and the Skowhegan Fair are about the only three big ones left in the state today.
How were the winters spent on the farm?
The winters, the farmers spent the winter on the farms. Of course, in those days, they all burned wood. And they had a wood lot on the farm. And I can remember that well on our own farm. We got up the logs, the long lumber, and then had a sawing machine. People used to go around with these power sawing machines and saw the wood up. Well, in that way, we got the wood for the next year. Well, where no one had anything but wood furnace and wood stoves, it took a lot of wood each year to heat every house. Well, then on top of that, for many years until they got the B&A potato houses, they had the potatoes in the cellar to get out and so forth. But there was always plenty of work for the farmers to do all went along.
How about recreation on the farm during the winter?
Well, of course, our big entertainment during the winter was riding in the sleighs and racing horses on the ice and so forth. And then the the women had whist clubs, as they called them, and so forth, and that entertained a lot of people, but there was something doing most of the time.
Where did you race the horses on the ice?
Huh?
Where did you race the horses on the ice?
Oh, we raced the horses. We used to scrape a place up above where Wilson's Mill used to be. Over near the town dump now, that stream up there. We used to get as far as we could, about a half a mile, just layer ice. And we'd have the horses and they'd race, and that was quite an event. Then another place we had was down the McDuck Snake Egg stream here below the Highland Bridge. Went down there. We went down there about a half a mile. Well, that was a great event, those winter horse racing, and there'd be always some fella have a retired Grand Circuit horse that could beat the rest. He'd appear here, and he'd have changed its name so we wouldn't know what horse it was, and so forth. And there were a lot of very quite smart things that some of these fellows thought of in connection with horse racing on the ice. I remember they had one at Fort Fairfield once. They were very famous, and Walter Cox, a famous Grand Circuit driver, had a horse that could had beaten about everything on the ice, and he brought him up here to race at Fort Fairfield. Well, Fort Fairfield, in those days, Philo Reed had some elegant horses, and they thought that he had one that might beat him. But anyway, well, I remember this, the fellow's telling about it. Walter Cox came up with this horse. Well, Walter was quite an old character, and they got up there, and they had a terrible storm for 2-3 days. Well, Walter had had some experience playing poker, and they stayed at the hotel there at Fort Fairfield for 2 days, and he played poker with all the innocent fellows that were there that were just amateurs compared with him. And when Walter had won $1,200 from him, he says, "Now look, gentlemen, it looks so it's going to snow another day, and I have won as much from you people as I would have if I'd have won the race. I guess I'll take my horse and go home." That created quite a lot of fun in Rooster County. He took his horse and went home and took their money, and they didn't have any race.
Around the turn?
Could you describe the farm buildings around the turn of the century?
Well, around the turn of the century, most farms had a very comfortable house on it. And, of course, there was always a big woodshed connected with the house because they've burned wood. Well, then there were generally 2 to 3 barns. There was always one barn, the nearest to the house, that they called the stable. That's where they kept their horses. Well, then there was a barn connected with that by a shed, in which they kept their cows and big mows in it to store hay and so forth. Well, then a lot of the farmers, as they grew and got to raising more stuff, would have a third barn which they would store hay in that they pressed and sold. Well, then every farmer had quite a large building for his hen house and so forth, and there were generally quite a few small buildings for different purposes around on a farm. But the big thing was the two barns, one for the horses and then a cattle barn. And of course there was sufficient room in each of those barns to store all the hay they would need. And that, well, then this third barn was for hay that they hoped to sell.
Do you remember any barn raisings in your youth?
Well, I well remember when a stable that Father had built, we had a barn raising. Well, a barn raising consisted of putting it, raising it up, the frame and everything, but previous to that, of course, all the lumber would be there. Well, then they'd have a barn raising, and that was the farmers, neighbors from miles around that all come to this barn raising. It was quite an event. Well, they would get the frame of the barn up, and the barn in that day practically closed in. And one of the things that they always planned to do was get the roof closed in. And that was typical all over the northern Maine here. These barn raisings were quite an event. And, of course, the poor housewives, when they had 30 or 40 men here all day to a barn race. And I can remember it up home just as well as over yesterday. Well, I think there were about 40 there. Well, now it was quite a job for the women of the house to feed all those men. And some barn racings through the country, sometimes they never wanted to have liquid refreshments around because it was no place for a fellow that had much booze or anything to be up on those rafters and be up on the barn. But anyway, they had a good time, and there were always plenty of fellows to come to go to it. I don't like it. Years ago, there were quite a few farmers used to tap trees, maple trees. I can remember, well,
when my wife's father tapped trees up here a lot, and would get a lot of sap and then boil it down and so forth, and it was always very good. But there were quite a few, like the Giroux out in Hodgson and different ones, kind of made a small business of it in the spring. They'd tap a lot of trees, and then they'd boil it down, and then they would have gallon cans of this syrup. Well, they would sell those all around town, and most everybody at least got 1 gallon of it. But, of course, that, I don't know if anyone does that now. Of course, conditions have changed here a lot since back in those days. I can remember well when I was 10, 12 years old of the Indians that were here. There were a few families of Indians. They were very reliable people. There was a couple camps right down about where Humphrey Flemington's house is now. They were on father and grandfather's land there. And there were different Indians, and they all worked around, and several of them worked for father. Well, in our home up there, there's a bedroom downstairs that Joe has now for a workshop, right opposite the dining room where there's a big fireplace. Well, back in those days, they never thought of locking the doors. Well, during the night, these Indians, some of the older ones, the reliable ones, would be out, and they'd be out late and be cold, and they'd want to get warm. And they'd come into grandfather's house, come right into the where the fireplace was, and they'd want a jackknife to make some shavings to start a fire to get warm, and they'd thump on grandfather's bedroom door, and he'd give them his knife. And then he'd turn over and go to sleep, and the Indians would have the fire. But, of course, that was an altogether different type of an Indian, but they had the run of the houses and everything. In 97, Louis Sokolexis, an Indian from Old Town, who was a very famous ball player, came up and went to Ricker. And, of course, in the spring, when we had a ball team, of course, he was one of the stars on it. And it was a very famous team with Jimmy Cox, who afterwards became one of the best college pitchers in the state, and George Morris was famous from Ashland, and Bob Vail from Hodgson. Well, then, at that time, Ricker was one of 4 Baptist fitting schools for Colby College, and every year they had a tournament. They had these 4 teams in, and they played. Well, Ricker went down with this team, with these fellas on it, Sokolexis among them. Well, they played Higgins the first game. Well, in the 5th inning, as I recall, it was about the middle of the game, and I think the 5th inning, they couldn't seem to get our team out. Our fellas were hitting home runs and I don't know what not. Anyway, they forfeited the game. Well, then after that, of course, Ricker team won all the games and were champions. But then Sokolexis did very well and got very good rank at Ricker. Then he went to Holy Cross and graduated from there. And, of course, he was the famous then as a ball player. The Cleveland team picked him up. And that's the way the Cleveland team came to be called the Cleveland Indians. Well, he got along wonderfully well. And until 1 year, they had won so many games that they had a big reception. Well, they had refreshments that was too bad for Sokolexis that he ever took any of them. But when he did, it was the beginning of the end, and eventually he lost out with the Cleveland Indians. And I can remember
after that, quite a few years of being down to Bangor one day and going along, and who stood on the corner there but Sock Alexis. And I stopped and talked to him, and he was a pretty sorry looking character then. He opened up and told me what he'd done, how he'd lost everything, hadn't anything, and he couldn't hardly get anything to eat and all of that. And I remember taking him into a restaurant there, and we had a good meal. But he was a wonderful fella, but that stuff got the upper hands of him, and he ended in pretty tough shape.